A couple of months ago, we compared how Germany and Japan have dealt with their war guilt. Now we take a look at Austria, the other significant player in the events of World War II. I think you're going to find it interesting.
Your son, the lawyer, how is he? I need advice from someone I can trust. Here she is, my aunt.
That's quite a painting.
She was taken off the walls of our home by the Nazis. Since then, she's been hanging in Vienna.
And now you'd like to be reunited.
And then there's justice.
The recent movie about the stolen Klimt painting, The Woman in Gold, raised a number of questions about Austria's Nazi past and its willingness to compensate those who were victims of the German Third Reich. Hello, this is Rear Vision on RN and via your ABC radio app. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we examine how well the Austrian state and the Austrian people have dealt with their past. Unlike Germany, Austria's relationship with the Nazis was complex. Adolf Hitler was, of course, an Austrian, and yet Austria was also the first country invaded by the Germans in 1938. So was Austria as complicit in the crimes of Nazi Germany? Dr. Winfield Garschar is a historian with the Documentation Centre of Austrian Resistance in Vienna.
Austria was both a victim as a state, because Austria was incorporated into the Nazi state against the will of its government, and Austria was involved in all those Nazi crimes, in part even on a leading position. But these were the Austrians as people and not the Austrian state. So there is a difference in responsibility, but Austria was an independent state until 1938. And in March 1938, Hitler threatened the Austrian federal chancellor, and the chancellor, Kurt Schuschnigg, gave in, and the Austrian government had to resign, and the new chancellor was an Austrian Nazi.
And so those images we see of Hitler driving into Vienna and the sort of cheering crowds, there was a sense, or a large percentage of the Austrian population, that was actually very sort of pleased to become part of the German Republic.
Yeah, this is the main difference between Austria as the first invaded country and all the other countries that followed. You only need to compare the pictures of Prague some months later in Vienna. In Vienna, you had this cheering crowd, and in Prague, you had also all the people, but the people were crying. They had tears in their eyes, and this was the main difference. Majority of the Austrian population welcomed Hitler, because for them, it was a big event, the German chancellor invading Austria and coming here and bringing all those new promises of the Nazis, because Austria at that time was a very poor country, and it was also a dictatorship, but it was a failed dictatorship. The Austrian dictator, the Austrian chancellor Schuschnigg, was not able to feed his own population. And this was one of the reasons why people cheered to Hitler. And the second reason was very Austrian one. In Austria, anti-Semitism was even more or deeper rooted than in Germany. In Vienna had a Jewish population of around 11%. And as soon as the German soldiers arrived in Vienna, you had an outbreak of the worst anti-Semitic pogroms you ever had seen in Central Europe since the Middle Ages. And this was also Austria. It was not Germany, it was Austria. So you had both. You had a government which had been replaced by the German occupiers. And on the other side, you had these cheering crowds and the anti-Semitic outbreak on the streets of Vienna.
In den deutschen Soldaten, die aus allen Gauen des Reiches in diesen Stunden einmarschieren, sehen Sie in ihnen Opferbereite und Opfergewillte Kämpfer für des ganzen großen deutschen Volkes Einheit für unseres Reiches.
There is no doubt that Austria, which ceased to exist after 1938, in 1938 Germany forcibly annexed Austria, but Austria as a part, as an integral part of the Third Reich, was deeply and intimately involved in the crimes of the Third Reich.
Thomas Berger is Professor of International Relations at Boston University and the author of War Guilt and War Politics After World War II.
Austrians, that is, individual Austrians, were very much part of the story. I mean, Hitler, of course, is the outstanding example, and Hitler was a virulent anti-Semite, and his anti-Semitism was very much born of a particular kind of moment in Austrian history. Jews had played a very large role in Austria's intellectual life. There were about 180,000 or so Jewish citizens of Austria after World War I, heavily concentrated in Vienna. Vienna was about 10% Jewish. They played a huge role in Austrian intellectual and cultural and social life. I mean, think about artists like Klimt or Schiele or composers like Mahler, Schoenberg, Sigmund Freud, Ludwig von Mises, the economist, Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher. I mean, the list could go on and on. And at the same time, the Jewish community in Austria became very much a sort of target of class resentment. And there were political figures, including the mayor of Vienna in the early 20th century, who was just using these kinds of chauvinistic anti-Semitism to rally support for him. This was very much sort of the role model for Hitler, and his anti-Semitism was born in that particular moment. Other Austrians as well, when Austria was taken over by Germany, there were very many people. I mean, there was almost immediately anti-Jewish pogroms broke out. Jews were being attacked. There was an Aryanization program, where Jewish property was taken away and Aryanized. Many Jews were killed. And there were many, many Austrians who were very happy to participate in these events. But there were also many people who were in tears, who were devastated by the disappearance of Austria. Now, once Austria became part of the Third Reich, various groups inside of Austria, including the labor unions, who had been traditionally socialist, including the Catholic Church, they came to terms. They made deals with the new Third Reich. And Austria quickly was integrated into the new regime. Austria disappeared as a country. It became this new German province called Ostmark, so sort of the Eastern Mark. Austrians were full-fledged citizens of the Third Reich. They were treated as, or viewed in sort of racial ideology of the time, as Aryans. And many Austrians participated. In fact, you take a look at the membership of the people who were involved in the final solution, the persecution of the Jews. They were disproportionately Austrian. Austria represented about 8% of the population of the Third Reich, but about 13% of the SS, about 40% of the concentration camp personnel, and as much as 70% of the people who headed the concentration camps were of Austrian background.
So when the war came to an end, what kind of position was Austria left in? And was it as devastated as other parts of Europe? And was it occupied in the same way that Germany was occupied?
The Allies did not trust Austria because of all the experiences of 1938, of the nasty pogrom on the streets of Vienna and all that, and also because of the role of Austrians in leading position of the Nazi hierarchy. And therefore, Austria was, as Germany, divided in four occupation zones by the four allies. The main difference was that in Austria, a common government for all Austria existed, first recognized only by the Soviets, but within a few months also recognized by the Western allies. And so this was a real difference towards Germany, where you had no common government, and therefore this division into four occupation zones, and later on the three Western and the one Eastern zone led to the composition of two states. This was not the case in Austria. The main difference, however, in my opinion, with regard to our topic we are talking here today, was that Austria was a small country. And then Austria had got a declaration by the Allies in 1943, if you are ready to fight for your own freedom, we are ready to reestablish Austria as an independent state, because you were the first victim of Nazi tyranny, of Hitler's expansion politics. And the Austrian politicians were very grateful to this offer of the Allies, and so they had the possibility to hide behind Germany, to say, it was the Germans, it was not the Austrians, it was the Germans. But of course, this was not true, and the Austrians themselves, they had to tackle the problem that thousands and tens of thousands of Austrian perpetrators, and they were brought before the courts. Before Austrian courts, not Allied courts. And this was the reason why the interior policy of Austria was absolutely contrary toward that, what they supposed to be internationally towards the Allied. This is we are victims. We are only victims. But of course, you had also in Austria all those trials against Nazi perpetrators, and you had first but only first efforts to give back what was stolen. The first restitution was very, very reluctant and not really done in a proper way. The Austrian government had hoped that the Jews will not come back and all those assets will fall to the Austrian state as a kind of equal the losses during the war. And it was not only ridiculous, it was shameful.
The Moscow Declaration of 1943 described Austria as the first victim of Hitler's aggression, and it was quickly adopted by the new Austrian political elite.
This was for them a convenient definition of the situation, and they very actively promoted this in terms of their rhetoric, you know, the things which political leaders like Leopold Feigl or Julius Raab were saying at that time. They set up exhibitions in museums. They had began the business of trying to portray a new history of Austria as a country which had been a victim of Nazism. And in addition to that, they began a very intensive period of pursuing former Nazis. They had war crime trials. There was a very far-reaching purge. All members of the Nazi party were stripped of political rights. They weren't allowed to vote, not allowed to hold office or work for the state. So there was a really strong denazification process which took place. However, the number of Austrians who had been involved in the Nazi regime was very large, and there were at least 500,000 voters. This is in a small country of about 6 million people at the time. 500,000 voters who were affected by this denazification. And the two dominant currents in post-war Austrian politics were the socialists on the one hand and the newly developed People's Party, or Volkspartei Österreich, who came out of the sort of Christian socialist tradition. And these two groups hated each other. And both of them, in very interesting ways, quite early in the late 1940s, began to actively court the political support. They knew that sooner or later, those former supporters of the Nazi regime were going to become politically a force, an important factor, possibly the deciding factor in Austrian politics. And both of them began to actively court those people. At the same time, this is in the late 1940s, against the backdrop of the unfolding Cold War, and indeed this Nazi potential which would organize itself into various forms and eventually emerge by the 1950s, what's now known as the Freedom Party, the Freiheitspartei Österreich, the Freedom Party of Austria, and become a very important political factor.
You're with Rear Vision on RN and via your ABC radio app. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're tracing the story of how Austria has dealt with its Nazi past. Willy Brandt, the German Chancellor, between 1969 and 74, led Germany towards a new understanding of its past. Was there anyone in Austria who did this?
No, because the equivalent for Brandt in Austria was his friend Bruno Kreisky. It was even like an European triumvirate. Palme in Sweden, Brandt in Germany, and Kreisky in Austria, three social democratic politicians, which had many common ideas. But there was one idea which was not common between Brandt and Kreisky. Kreisky himself was Jew, but Kreisky was not ready to make anything similar like when Brandt fell on his knees before the monument in Warsaw. Kreisky did not want that. He feared the anti-Semitic resentments of parts of the Austrian population, and he did not want to tackle that problem. It was under his chancellorship where all the trials against Nazi perpetrators were stopped. It was in the middle of the 1970s, and there was no successful trial concluded by a judgment since 1975 in Austria. And this was also one of the results of Kreisky's politic of modernization. He did not want to look back to the Nazi time, and he did not want even to tackle with the students' movement. He had big problems with the party's students, the social democratic students, and there was even a rupture between the leadership of the party and the leadership of the students' movement, because the social democratic students, they wanted to discuss the role of Austrians during the Nazi time.
Austria was living the sort of myth, enjoying the myth of being the greatest victim, first victim of Nazism. It was official Austrian policy. It also led to a very different approach on the part of the two countries towards issues such as reparations and compensation. Already in the 1950s, the question of whether Austria should pay compensation to the victims of Nazism was raised very strongly. There were some efforts. There had been something like 4,300 large firms or so on, which in the past had been Jewish property and which were led to compensation. But there were still thousands and thousands of smaller properties, clinics, apartments, sanitariums, bank accounts and so forth, which had not been dealt with. The Austrians never at that point in time offer compensation to people living outside of Austria who had not been previously Austrian citizens. So the Austrians had some efforts at restitution. Germany, in contrast, already in the 1950s, beginning with a treaty which was signed with the State of Israel, began to make large-scale restitution, paid large amounts of compensation to the victims of Nazism. And the sums were really quite extraordinary. I mean, I think over the course of the Cold War and the rest of the 20th century, the state of Germany paid something on the order of $100 billion in restitution, not Austria. Austria continued to hold on to this position in the 1970s and 1980s, but it became increasingly uncomfortable with that.
Next month, the Austrians elect their new president. Not a world-shaking event, but the candidacy of Dr. Kurt Waldheim has changed all that. When the World Jewish Congress accused Waldheim of being a former Nazi, an officer involved in atrocities in the Balkans.
Waldheim is being asked to prove that he isn't a Nazi war criminal. Over the past 40 years, Waldheim has maintained that he was wounded on the Russian front in 1941, was sent home to Vienna, and completed his law studies.
That is a patent lie. We have captured Nazi war documents bearing Kurt Waldheim's signature, showing that, in fact, he was an intelligence officer.
There were a whole series of incidents, but I think the most important one was came in the late 1980s when Kurt Waldheim, who had been the former Secretary General of the United Nations, became candidate to become the President of the Austrian Republic. Presidency in Austria is a largely ceremonial role, but it's an important role. And both the socialists and the conservatives in Austria supported his candidacy for that position. However, Kurt Waldheim, during the war, had claimed that he had been a law student who had been wounded and then, after being wounded, had sat out the war. In reality, he had been attached to the staff of the German army fighting in Yugoslavia. He was an intelligence officer, and he was, therefore, at the center of a large-scale and very brutal counterinsurgency project in which literally hundreds of thousands, millions of people were being killed. However, that particular history had been covered up, but it was raised. It was raised by Austrians and it was raised by the international press in the late 1980s, and it led to an enormous uproar that a figure like Kurt Waldheim could come back and become president of Austria. Nonetheless, what happened was that for a brief while, there was a kind of rally around the flag. Outsiders shouldn't be telling Austria how to run its own business. And Kurt Waldheim was elected president with a large majority. But Austria, as a result, was ostracized. For the next few years, during the time he was in office as Austrian president, I don't think he had a single state visit. There was one state visit that he made to the Vatican. The Ronald Reagan administration in the United States actually put him on the list of do not fly, an unwanted persons list. There was a growing sense that Austria was being isolated, not only because of the Waldheim affair, but more generally because of its position on the past by the rest of the world. And this became particularly important after the Cold War.
At the end of the Cold War, international pressure mounted on Austria, especially from the European Union.
Austria during the Cold War had been a neutral country. It traded with the West. It was part of a kind of European Free Trade Association, EFTA. It enjoyed many of the benefits of access to the European Union, but was not a member of the European Union. And in the early 1990s, it became clear that Austria was going to join the European Union. And the European Union, at the same time, made it very clear to Austria that if it wanted to become a member of the EU, it was going to have to do something about the issue of restitution. And this led to a major rethinking in the early 1990s on the part of the Austrian government about how they should approach these issues, with the Waldheim affair very much in the background. Basically, on the basis of a very practical kind of calculation of Austrian national interest, the Franz Vranitzky government, which was a conservative government which came to power in the early 1990s, decided that it was going to take the bull by the horns and move away from this notion of Austria as the first victim of Nazism. This led to a series of speeches, apologies on the part of heads of leading Austrian political leaders for Austria's role in the Holocaust. Instead of the myth of Austria as being Nazism's first victim, they moved instead to what's known as the co-responsibility, Mitverantwortungsthese, the co-responsibility thesis, which is that Austria had been in fact part of the Third Reich and therefore bore along with Germany some of the responsibility for what happened.
Austria has been rocked for days by violent protests against the swearing-in of its new government in a coalition which includes the neo-fascist Freedom Party.
When he first made world headlines by belittling Nazi war crimes, there was no doubt Austria's right-wing nationalist Jörg Haider was an extremist. But when his far-right Freedom Party won a large swag of the democratic vote in Austria's elections, it was clear this was an extremist with real power.
At the beginning of the 2000s, the Conservative Party, the Austrian People's Party, joined with the far-right Austrian Freedom Party to form government, and many feared that this would lead to an end to any form of restitution. But in fact, the reverse happened.
Of course it's a paradox, but on the other side, you can clearly explain that. These leading people of that government, they had to face so much criticism from outside, from other European countries, inside the European Union. You had a strong resentment against this new right-wing government in Austria. It was the first in the EU. Later on, you had Silvio Berlusconi in Italy and Viktor Orban in Hungary, for instance. But this was the first case where such a far right-wing government led a member state of the European Union. They wanted to prove that it is not true that they are a semi-fascist government, that they wanted to prove that they are ready to tackle the Nazi past and they are able to do it. And this was the background for the so-called Washington Agreement with leading Jewish organizations all over the world to tackle this huge task, because in many, many cases you had complicated quarrels between heirs or supposed heirs of Jewish property. And it was very hard to give back all that after so many decades because, for instance, many, many famous paintings that had been stolen from Jews had sold and resold again. And who is now the real proprietor of such a painting, for instance? And the same was with other assets like houses and woods and fields and so on. It was this conservative government who was forced to do that to prove that they are not what all the world claimed that they are, a far-right-wing government which is not ready to tackle the Nazi past.
So how did they begin that process? Like, how did it begin when they decided, yes, we are going to tackle this? What was the process they put in place to actually do it?
They installed a commission of historians, of experts for restitution cases, and first they did research into what had been stolen during the Nazi time, and then they started from 1945, what had been given back, what, in which kind Jews or Jewish organizations had got at least money as a kind of replacement for stolen assets that could not be restored or that had been sold to foreign countries and so on. And this was quite a lot, but it was much too less. And then they tried to find heirs for this Jewish property, and then there was commission, for instance, for restitution of assets, and there were also commissions in many institutions in Austria for what had been incorporated, for instance, in libraries, in public libraries, in museums that had had Jewish proprietors before.
They're going to put as many obstacles in your way as possible.
She is the Mona Lisa of Austria.
We will fight you till the end for something we believe is ours.
We're here to file a lawsuit.
We're taking the Austrian government to court.
Have a nice day.
All along, you have thwarted me and closed the doors in my face.
This is a case of one woman wanting justice.
You mentioned women in gold. There are two or three examples in the art restitution which were really not a good example. But when you look at it in the long run, since 1998, Austria gave back about 30,000 objects out of the museums.
Eva Brimlinger was the research coordinator of the Austrian Historical Commission between 1998 and 2004.
But there are still things which are not clear, and the whole thing with Maria Altmann was really not a good example. But on the other hand, you have a lot of good examples which do not find their way in the international media. So I guess it's really a change in the mentality. As you can see, there were a lot of things done in the last, I would say, 15, 20 years. And sure, there can be done more. It's not everything clear, but the problems which were in the 80s, you don't have anymore. And when I look at I'm in the commission for the art restitution, that's always a discussion, because sometimes we had a case, Fritz Grünbaum, it's also an international case. We had a decision last week where we refused to give it back because we have not enough evidence of the whole story of the pictures. And this will be the next discussion, but it's really difficult after 70 years to get all the information and to find a good solution for both sides, especially for the victims.
If you watch this movie, The Woman of Gold, you'll find lots of examples for what has been done even in this time when the restitution was on the agenda, but there were still bureaucrats who did not want to do that. There are even ministers, members of the government who wanted to be a little bit more reluctant towards heirs. And also up to today, you have those efforts to hinder all that, especially in cases when the possible heirs cannot agree upon something.
After 70 years, when most of the victims are now dead, should Austria still be paying for its Nazi past?
These kinds of questions can emerge again and again. My own country, the United States, continues to wrestle very much with the legacy of slavery. I don't think you can understand American politics in isolation from this enormous historical problem. And that historical problem, of course, did not end in 1865. It did not end in 1965. It kept on taking on new meaning. And some of these questions again come up in the context of Ferguson, Missouri, and the question of the ongoing institutionalized legacy of slavery and racism in this country. Can you say that these issues end? Well, I think they, in legal sense, there may be certain kinds of limitations, but these questions have remarkable longevity, and they can continue to reemerge again and again. Again, you might say that what happens in the Middle East is not directly related to the questions of Nazi Germany. But very often, what happens is that the same set of political forces, sometimes even the political descendants of the same people, become involved in this fight. So many of the same people who are opposed, virulently opposed to immigration, who are afraid that their countries are not going to be able to integrate socially, economically, and intellectually, ideologically, the wave of Muslim immigrants who are coming out of the Middle East. Some of those people harken back to the Freedom Party of Austria, in a particular Völkische, that is, ethnic understanding of what the Austrian and or German nation is all about and what Europe is all about. And so these issues, again, take on new resonance in the modern context.
Thomas Berger, the author of War, Guilt and War Politics After World War II. My other guests, Eva Brimlinger, former research coordinator at the Austrian Historical Commission, and Winfield Garschar, historian with the Documentation Centre of Austrian Resistance. Today's sound engineer is Russell Stapleton. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN.